Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Supreme Court is hearing a case today that could open the floodgates to hundreds of lawsuits against manufacturers of vaccines. So let's start with a check-in there today. A Pittsburgh family says their daughter was perfectly healthy until she was given the diphtheria tetanus pertussis vaccine at 6 months of age, after which she suffered debilitating seizures, which still affect her 18 years later. Now, a 1986 federal law limits lawsuits against vaccine manufacturers. It instead requires that cases go to a special vaccine court. The Pittsburgh family went through that court, which rejected their claim. Now they're suing for the right to sue in regular court. What impact will this case have on hundreds of other families, including those who claim vaccines cause autism? Bloomberg News Supreme Court reporter Greg Storr joins us. Greg, remind us, why is there a vaccine court in the first place?
Robin, Congress set up this court because it wanted to encourage vaccine makers to make vaccines without having to worry about huge liability in the event that some side effects took place, which they generally know that they will with vaccines. So Congress set up the system that requires families to go first to the vaccine court, and then if they're not happy with what takes place there, they can try to sue in court in some cases.
To ensure that there's a flow of vaccines into the country and have a little bit of a shield for manufacturers.
That's right. The idea was to encourage vaccines to be put out there on the market and to encourage people to use the vaccines on their children, knowing that if there was a problem, they at least have some possibility of receiving compensation.
Well, what does it mean that the vaccine court rejected this Pittsburgh family's initial claim that the Wyeth vaccine had injured their daughter? She is obviously injured. Was the court saying it wasn't from the vaccine?
That's exactly right. The one thing you do have to show if you go to the vaccine court is that the vaccine caused the injury. And the vaccine court in this case said that there was not that causal connection between the vaccine and the seizures.
So the family then went to other federal courts. What happened there?
They lost. The court said that they could not bring the claim that they're seeking to bring. Specifically, they say that Wyeth had a different formulation of the vaccine that was being used for older children. The Brucewitz family says that is a safer formulation, and Wyeth should have used that vaccine, should have asked the FDA to approve that vaccine for infants. The issue in the Supreme Court is whether they can bring that particular type of case. The case that says that there was a safer formulation. Every lower court, except for one, that has considered that question has said, no, you can't bring that type of claim. The Supreme Court is now going to decide whether under the vaccine law, you can bring that type of claim.
Why can't you bring that type of claim?
The law says that vaccine manufacturers won't be liable for damages for any injury that was unavoidable. And basically the question is whether that means that, as is alleged here, there is an avoidable injury, avoidable because allegedly there was a safer formulation, whether you can bring that type of claim.
Well, the vaccine court also set up a special study of autism and vaccines, and they found no connection. So why might this Supreme Court case open up a flood of possible lawsuits regarding autism?
Because the vaccine court's conclusion on that matter wouldn't be binding on a jury. There are some 350 lawsuits out there that say that, notwithstanding what the vaccine court said, vaccines do indeed cause autism. And what the companies say they're worried about is if you end up with 350 cases going to a jury, there's a chance that one or more juries will reach the opposite conclusion.
So it sounds as if the U.S. government, which sides with the manufacturers in this case currently at the Supreme Court, worries that it's just too dangerous to allow these kinds of trials against vaccine makers to go to juries across the country because it might stop the flow of vaccines into the country if one of these companies is taken down.
That's exactly right. The Obama administration is indeed siding with Wyeth, and the concern they express is that if it becomes too expensive for vaccine makers to produce these and put them on the market, they might stop doing so, and that would be a public health problem.
Bloomberg News Supreme Court reporter Greg Storr on today's Supreme Court consideration of whether or not people can sue manufacturers of vaccines. Greg, thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, it's been 6 months since President Obama's health care reforms were signed into law. More than a dozen new coverage requirements are now in effect. So how's it going? In some ways, very well. Tax credits to defray costs for small businesses are on track. $250 checks were sent out to people who fell into Medicare's dreaded donut hole. Also, insurers now are required to provide free preventive care for things like pap smears and mammograms. But the Associated Press recently reported that people with pre-existing conditions have not signed up for coverage in the numbers expected. According to the AP, California has money to cover about 20,000 people. Only around 450 applications have been received. And 45% of Americans say they're still confused by the new health care law. So today, let's get a report card. Jacob Hacker teaches political science at Yale. He's author of Healthcare for America, a proposal for affordable national health care sponsored by the Economic Policy Institute. So he's got, you know, some dog in this hunt. And he recently graded the healthcare rollout in a New York Times op-ed piece. Jacob, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And let's start with pre-existing conditions. As we understand it, in 2014, all insurers will have to accept applicants regardless of their medical history. In the interim, there is this pre-existing condition insurance plan. It's kind of a federal and state high-risk pool. To qualify for coverage, applicants have to have had trouble getting insurance because of a pre-existing condition. They have to be U.S. citizens or legal residents. They have to have been uninsured for 6 months. Now, we're reading of people for whom this program is a lifesaver. Cancer victims, for instance, who now have coverage that they didn't have before. But why aren't more people signing up?
Well, this isn't a huge surprise. The states have already often run high-risk insurance pools, and they are in some states oversubscribed. There are too many people on the list. But often the numbers are smaller than you would expect given the need. And I think there are a couple reasons for that. One is, of course, some people are just not aware of these pools. But if you're someone who's been denied coverage for a pre-existing condition and have a serious medical problem, you're obviously going to know about some of the major insurance options you have. So another issue is that these pools are set up to provide insurance and thus not to discriminate against people who have pre-existing conditions, but the coverage can still be quite a lot of money.
Sure.
And there is not much in the way of support out there in existing policies, nor in the new state and federal pools.
Well, we're reading, for instance, the premiums may still be, $400 to $600. That's still too high for some people. The deductibles, $5,000. Now we read about a woman whose chemotherapy sessions are, $16,000. So she's thrilled with a $5,000 deductible and some coverage. But again, this is too high for some people. Also, people are required to provide documentation that they have been turned down, and in many cases they just don't have that, in part because they didn't even try.
That's right, and I think one of the problems with the high-risk pools in general is that they're seen as these kind of residual pools that you have to prove that you can't get coverage by any means in the private sector to enter. And as a result, the hurdles to get that coverage have historically been very high. My hope was that with these new state and federal pools, and as you mentioned up front, in many of the states, 27 states have such pools themselves now under the new law, and mm-hmm. the federal government is setting up its own pool for those who are not receiving coverage through state pools. That the hope was that this new effort, which had more federal funding behind it, perhaps not sufficient funding according to the experts, was going to be able to provide, a much more attractive option and also one that was higher profile because people know about the healthcare law even if they don't know what's in it. And I think it's a little too early to have a negative verdict, but it reinforces the conclusion that just providing coverage to this high-risk population is very difficult. The premiums are high because the people who are most in need of coverage and protection, people like the patient you mentioned before who had chemotherapy, are the ones most likely to sign up. And so even with federal subsidies, even with help to the states to set these pools up, the premium has to be very high. That means there's lots of people who have medical conditions and who have a hard time getting coverage in the private market who nonetheless see it as too costly to go into these pools.
Well, in Wisconsin, for instance, they have room for about 8,000 people. They've got fewer than 300 applicants. So if the issue is getting the word out, We just got that word out. Let's move on to other recently enacted requirements of the new health law. Parents now allowed to add or keep their children on their own policies up to the age of 26. We read retirees are discovering that they are in many cases not included in this benefit. And also some people have let us know that they have to wait till a certain time in their policy, so they can't do it right away. But how else is this going?
Well, I gave the overall grade for the rollout so far a B, and I should emphasize that, you know, and I got some comments to the effect that that might reflect the grade inflation in the Ivy Leagues, but I assure you that I consider a B to be a fair grade at this point. And we really don't have a whole lot to go on, but so far the rollout of the bill at the federal level has been quite successful. Personnel have been put in place, regulatory deadlines have been met, federal activity is on schedule. Financing looks secure for now. The main problems so far are at the state level. I think the states have been much slower to act, except for those states that are acting very quickly to sue the federal government over the law. And among the different players that really have to cooperate to make the law work, so employers, insurers, providers, and the parties.
Well, Jacob, in the couple minutes before the break, let's jump in on a question about insurers. The new law makes it illegal to cancel policies for people who are sick, including children. Now, many companies, Aetna, Anthem, Blue Cross, have threatened to get out of the business of selling child-only policies because of this requirement. Now, these child-only plans, you've told us, are a very small part of the market. This is when, parents are uninsured themselves and don't qualify for state-level insurance, but they want to insure their children. And, places like California are having to deal with companies saying they're going to pull out. So California is saying back to some of these insurance companies, well, then we won't let you come into our exchange. How is this playing out, this idea of, not covering children if they're sick?
Well, the first thing to say is that the real effects of the law are going to become apparent in 2014 when there's a requirement on employers and individuals, large employers and individuals, to offer coverage. There's going to be this integrated set of subsidies. There's going to be these new health insurance exchanges. So it is important to understand that these early steps in the law have to balance two competing aims. On the one hand, requiring that insurers or employers do certain things, and on the other hand, the fear that you might actually discourage them from voluntarily providing coverage, or in the case of insurers, from offering coverage at all. I think that what the insurer is doing is unconscionable and really shows that insurers are not playing along. I gave them a D on my grading scale, but I do think it's important to put that into the context of this overall law, that in the early years there's this balancing act that the federal government and state governments are having to engage in.
Well, and by the way, the insurers say that they're concerned that parents will wait to get coverage for their kids until their kids are sick and will overload the insurance agency. So big disagreement on that issue. We're talking with healthcare analyst Jacob Hacker about healthcare reform. How's it going? And as we heard, at least one sticking point there on the requirement that people who are sick get coverage, including children. When we come back, how come McDonald's got a waiver? And other questions about healthcare reform with Jacob Hacker. Also later, don't forget, a website trying to reach kids who are being bullied because they're gay. Back in 1 minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We've been talking to Yale political science professor and healthcare expert Jacob Hacker about the new law reforming healthcare. How's it doing? We'll link you to his op-ed piece, pretty much grading the rollout of healthcare reform, everyone from employers to the insurance industry to the government, at our website, hereandnow.org. But Jacob, I want to talk about a couple aspects of the law and how corporations have responded. The new law removes lifetime caps on how much insurance people can use. One of the things that's irritating companies like McDonald's. Now, McDonald's recently threatened to drop its insurance altogether because it has something called a mini-med. It has, very, very low coverage, very minimal coverage. But McDonald's says, hey, at least it's coverage, and we're going to drop it unless we get a waiver. It did get a waiver from the government, along with, I think, 30 other insurers, employers, and union plans, 1-year waivers on the new rules. Your thoughts about that?
Well, my thoughts are that this really reinforces my earlier point that there's a dilemma here in the early years of the Affordable Care Act. And until there's these integrated requirements on employers and individuals and these new federal subsidies for coverage and the exchanges to allow people to get coverage outside the workplace, those who are putting in place the law are worried about the degree to which they might be discouraging employers or insurers from providing coverage in the first place. In the case of these mini med plans, I think that they will not meet the requirements for credible coverage when the full law goes into effect. These are incredibly limited plans. They provide you pay $14 a week for a policy that doesn't cover more than $2,000 in medical bills a year. This is hardly insurance at all. But right now, the administration is concerned that McDonald's or other companies that provide such limited benefits would drop their coverage altogether until the full bill takes effect, until there's federal subsidies to allow people to get coverage through these exchanges where they can choose among comprehensive insurance options.
Well, a couple things. First of all, you say when the full law goes into effect in 2014, but we're wondering what happens when the waiver is up in 1 year.
Yeah, it's a good question. And, you know, the rush to provide these waivers, I think, really does underscore this, the dilemma that I've talked about, and also a tricky issue that I think all of us Americans are somewhat responsible for. And that is, the tricky issue is that at the one and the same time we were told there will be no changes in your health care if you like it, and at the same time we'll make sure to fix those things about health care that don't work, such as millions of Americans lacking coverage and costs rising dramatically out of control. And frankly, you just can't do that. You can't have these major reforms that will encourage broader coverage and also bring down costs without having some effect on the coverage that people have. And sometimes that coverage, as in the case of McDonald's and workers, is just really bad coverage, and there needs to be something else in its place. In the meantime, though, we're sort of struggling to figure out, well, how do we balance the fact that this is at least some coverage with the reality that it's very inadequate.
What kind of leverage does the government have? We there are fines that employers will have to pay if they drop coverage of their employees. And as we said, states like California are saying to insurers who are saying they will stop covering children if, in fact, they're forced to cover sick children. California is saying to those insurers, well, then we're not going to let you into our huge exchanges, you know, which will be a huge money loss for you. But what else can the government say to a company like McDonald's that threatens to drop its insurance if, in fact, they don't care about paying the fees?
Well, if they don't care about paying the fees, then that is in some ways not an unhappy outcome, right? So if McDonald's says, okay, rather than providing incredibly anemic coverage, we instead pay a reasonable amount on behalf of our workers, and they get coverage to these new exchanges where they can choose among a range of good private options, that's a win-win situation. It's just right now, without the exchanges and without the more robust regulations on insurers, we're not able to sort of, the federal regulators really aren't able to say that. Now, my sense of this is that part of what is going on is that employers are basically trying to sort of push back by threatening to drop coverage, even though they probably aren't actually going to drop coverage, and that the degree to which the administration sort of rushed to accommodate McDonald's is going to send a signal to a lot of other employers that if they want to have special dispensation in the short term, the first thing they should do is talk about how likely it is they're going to drop their coverage.
Yeah. Well, and we remind ourselves that you gave overall the grade of B to the new health care reform law. You know, the government is committed, you say. Most of the stakeholders are committed. And there's some evidence that Americans are liking the steps. Certainly the cancer patient who gets coverage, even though she has a pre-existing condition. But there's still a lot of confusion. There's a large proportion of Americans who say that there are death panels.
Yes, and as I pointed out in the piece, the confusion level has dropped since the bill was passed, but still is almost 50%. So roughly 45% of people said they were confused about the new legislation. What the polls show is that overall Americans feel very anxious about the the Affordable Care Act. But when you start to look at the specifics, including allowing kids to stay on their parents' insurance policies or banning exclusion of coverage for pre-existing conditions or providing new options for people to get private insurance, those ideas are overwhelmingly popular. And there is some sign that, as the bill has unfolded, that popularity for it has increased. In fact, you're seeing a little bit of this on the campaign trail with some Democrats, just a handful, arguing that if their Republican opponents win, that there'll be a push to roll back the health care law and that this would be something that Americans wouldn't want. And I would say the lowest grade I gave, because the grades were really based on whether or not there was cooperation with the new law, was to Republicans, who have vowed that if they take Congress, they're going to chip away at the law bit by bit. So, you know, the Affordable Care Act is it's sort of like a house that is just being constructed, but it's being constructed in the path of a hurricane, namely rising health care costs and a very strong Republican backlash.
Jacob Hacker, got to leave it at that. He's with Yale. Again, his healthcare report card will be at hereandnow.org. Back in 1 minute, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, where partners have been giving clients practical legal advice for over 100 years throughout New England, and now including Connecticut, online at haslaw.com, and the Institute of Contemporary Art on the Boston waterfront. Discover the power and beauty of new art and ideas, icaboston.org.
A lot of big debates coming this week. Democrat Harry Reid and Republican Sharon Angle in the Senate fight in Nevada. Democrat Chris Coons and Republican Christine O'Donnell in Delaware's Senate battle. And tonight, the third and final debate in the California governor's race. So let's check in there and do so. We have to issue a language alert. Democrat Jerry Brown remains a few points ahead of Republican Meg Whitman, according to polls taken after an allegation that Whitman knowingly employed an illegal immigrant. But before, a Brown campaign aide called Whitman a whore for supporting pension benefits for a police group endorsing her. Now, that exchange was recorded on a police union official's phone machine after Jerry Brown thought he'd hung up. Here's a snippet. You'll hear the aide first.
Yeah, she's a whore.
She's a whore. Well, I could use that. John Myers is Sacramento Bureau Chief for the California Report on KQED. And John, the Brown campaign apologized. We all were reminded to hang up before we start talking after leaving a message. But other than that, how is this resonating?
Well, you know, Robin, it's hard to tell so far. I mean, this has been the second of what I would call the oddball issues in the last couple of weeks. Before that, we had revelations that the Republican candidate, Meg Whitman, who is the former CEO of eBay, had hired a housekeeper several years ago that she thought was a documented immigrant, was an undocumented immigrant. And, of course, that became a bit of a fracas in this race because Whitman has talked pretty tough, not only on illegal immigration, but on cracking down on people who hire undocumented immigrants. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see what the public reacts to. The polls basically show this race still very tight.
Well, the day after the tape was released, the National Organization of Women endorsed Jerry Brown. So you write in your Capital Notes blog today that the electorate is grumpy. What do you think the questions are that should be answered tonight?
First and foremost, what do you do to solve California's problems? I mean, over 12% unemployment, tens of thousands of teachers laid off as the state had budget problems. I think, you know, these candidates do need to differentiate themselves from the person they're trying to replace, Arnold Schwarzenegger, who currently has a 28% approval rating in the polls. Meg Whitman, again, a first-time candidate, former CEO, pledges to run the state more like a business, has laid out a bit of a blueprint of what she would do, but it begs a lot of other extra questions, like, you know, she says she's going to create lots of jobs and she's going to cut, you know, waste, fraud, and abuse out of state government. She hasn't really detailed how she gets to those kinds of things. Jerry Brown, on the other end, as we know, is an iconoclast in California politics, 40 years, ran for president, been governor, everything else you can imagine. And Brown's message basically is, well, I have the leadership skills that'll change California, and I know how the process at the state house works. Well, that's great, except he hasn't offered a lot of specifics about what he would do other than be a good leader.
Well, you mentioned the state's deficit, $19 billion last week. After a 100-day impasse, the state legislature finally passed a budget, but it includes no new taxes or fees. And it does include pension and budget reforms and some, you know, some would say creative accounting. And pension reforms, you know, that goes to that taped phone conversation. The discussion was about pension benefits. So is that, you know, maybe one of the questions, you know, not just who said what about whom, but what are you going to do about the pensions?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And it is really worth talking about just a moment because, you know, setting aside the derogatory comment in that audio tape, let's look at exactly what Brown's criticism was, that he believed that Ms. Whitman's stance of saying that public safety workers could keep their current pension benefits, which are pretty generous, and that every other state worker would have to go to a 401k-style plan, was disingenuous, and that there was no way to solve the state's financial problems if you're going to exclude a whole group of state workers from having their pensions reformed. That, I think, has been missed a little bit in the coverage of this audio tape and the salacious nature of it.
By the way, Meg Whitman now holds the U.S. record for the amount spent for a statewide office, $119 million of her own money. What impact is that having on this campaign?
Yeah, it's really interesting, Robin. There was a stat out the other day that at this point in time, the average California television viewer will see 26 of her television ads in a single hour. Now, that's a saturation level that we've never seen before. I don't think most people in politics, and national politics even, haven't seen that. And I do think that does raise a question, too, about whether or not they're working. I mean, again, this is a tied race. Has all of that money and all of that messaging really gotten her past the mark that she needs to win this race?
John Myers, Sacramento Bureau Chief for the California Report on KQED. John, thank you.
You're welcome.
Back with Dan Savage in 30 seconds, here and now. Welcome back. Police in New York are continuing their investigation into what they call the worst anti-gay attack in recent memory, a group of men accused of brutally torturing a gay 30-year-old and two teens for hours. The attack came after Rutgers University freshman Tyler Clementi jumped to his death off the George Washington Bridge on September 22nd, one of a spate of young suicides around the country, allegedly provoked by taunting. Well, the suicides prompted sex advice columnist and author Dan Savage to put up a video online with him and his partner, Terry, talking about their experience growing up gay. Let's listen to a portion.
I was picked on because, you know, I liked musicals and I was obviously gay, and some kids didn't like that, and I did get harassed.
My school was pretty miserable. I lived in Spokane, Washington, which is a mid-sized town with a small-town mentality, and I was picked on mercilessly in school. People were really cruel to me. I was bullied a lot, beat up, thrown against walls and lockers and windows, you know, stuffed into bathroom stalls. Honestly, things got better the day I left high school.
It gets better, but you have to tough this period of it out, and you have to live your life so that you're around for it to get amazing, and it can and it will.
Well, now people from around the world have put up their own videos telling bullied kids to hold on. It's called the It Gets Better Project. We'll link you at our website, herenow.org, and Dan Savage joins us. Dan, what was your thinking in launching the site?
Well, I heard about the suicide of Justin Aberg in Minnesota, who was 15 years old and brutally bullied, and then shortly thereafter, the suicide of Billy Lucas. And I had the reaction so many of us gay adults had when we hear these stories, which is, I wish I could have talked to that kid for 5 minutes and been able to tell him that it gets better. But we would have that reaction knowing that the parents and homophobic teachers and school administrators and homophobic preachers wouldn't give us permission to talk to these kids. And it occurred to me that in the era of YouTube and Facebook and Twitter, I was waiting for permission that I didn't need anymore, that I could make a video and speak directly to them about our experience with bullying, about how we survived it, how they could survive it, and that life isn't a gay adult, an openly gay adult, was good and happy, and that they should hang in there.
A lot of kids could use that advice, gay or not, to hang in there. But there are people who think, well, yeah, we've heard about these extraordinary stories, but by and large, people are so much more accepting. There's characters on television. You say things aren't getting better, they're getting worse. Why?
They're getting worse depending on where you are. If you're growing up in a Seattle or a big liberal tolerant town, you'll have access to resources and there'll be role models and other gay people around. But if you're growing up in a Greensburg, Indiana, or the unincorporated part of Houston County where Asher Brown took his own life, you're really isolated. And you're isolated in a way that a bullied straight teenager is not. You know, a bullied straight kid at school goes home almost invariably to parents who love and support him or her. and at the very least a shoulder to cry on. The bullied gay kid, bullied, you know, 13, 14, 15-year-old gay kid, goes home almost invariably to more bullying from his parents, who believe that they can terrorize their kid out of being gay somehow.
Is that really true? Do you think that most parents of gay children, as they're realizing their sexuality, are bullying them? Do you really think that's true?
It depends on where you are. I think it is true in a rural or conservative area where people believe that, you know, homosexuals have been told from the pulpit repeatedly by an aggressive hate campaign waged by the religious right that homosexuality is a choice. And so they believe that they can bully their kids who are gay out of making that choice. This kind of hate rhetoric has consequences, real-life consequences, for gay and lesbian teenagers all over the country. You know, even gay kids who have parents who might support them, parents often don't say anything because they don't want to embarrass or humiliate their kids who are, you know, gay or being picked on for being gay by going to them and saying, "Are you gay? I love you anyway, but please tell me if you need help or love or support." So you have these kids who may have supportive families, but they don't know it.
Well, meantime, what are some of the things that people are saying on your website now, adults who are telling kids, hang in there?
There's a lot of videos from people who are giving practical advice about how to cope, about how to find support wherever they are right now, and a lot of inspiring stories across all different social types, classes, races, religious affiliations. That's what's so tremendously moving about the site now is that so many people from so many different walks of life have poured in to tell their stories.
Let's listen.
Hi, my name is Bruce, and, you know, I guess fast forward to my freshman year of college, and, you know, without going into way too much detail, you know, after a series of events, I found myself in the ER and ICU after an attempted overdose. You know, I'm very thankful that I was given the second chance, and because now the people that I thought weren't going to be supportive are my number one supporters. You know, I have a really wonderful partner. I remember during an engagement party for my sister, my dad and my partner were actually outside, and my dad actually looked at him and said something to the effect of, "When is it going to be you and my son getting married?"
Do you have a sense that kids are looking at the site?
Absolutely. We're getting tons of emails from teenagers who are watching the site, emails from teachers and school administrators who are surreptitiously slipping the word about the site to students they think may need to see it. And most heartbreakingly of all, emails from moms and dads who have bullied 13, 14, 15-year-old kids who are being bullied because of they're gay or perceived to be gay, who are sitting down at the computer with their kids to watch these videos. And they're writing me to thank me and tell me that the videos are helping their kids.
Yeah. One woman writes, "I showed him your site. He sat down and watched the video that you and Terry, your partner, put up. Since then, I've seen him checking the site. I don't know if he's gay, but I do know that your message has touched him." And this is someone who has been taunted for not being athletic, you know, not being in the ROTC, as some others are, where he lives in rural Kentucky. So, Dan Savage, you've chosen YouTube to put this forum up on. You know what's happened when schools have tried to do the same thing? There was Minnesota's Anoka-Hennepin School District, which got the worst invective I've ever seen, the superintendent said, after they tried to do something about their anti-bullying strategies in the aftermath of a gay student suicide.
And the people they were mostly harassed by were so-called self-described Christians who were opposed to the anti-bullying program because it addressed anti-gay bullying. Look at the guy running for governor of New York who said all those insanely homophobic things. You know, we can't say that being gay is equally valid or successful. We can't brainwash our children into tolerating gays and lesbians. Here's a man who had an extramarital affair and has a second family, basically, had a daughter out of wedlock with an employee while he was married to another woman who also he had also had his children with. And he's lecturing us about what is and isn't moral. And that's really what it's come down to. So many Christians now define public morality as posturing against gays and lesbians, and that's it. They can marry and divorce and have children out of wedlock, and they're still good Christians if they hate gay people.
That's sex advice columnist and author Dan Savage, the man behind the It Gets Better project. Dan, we'll link our listeners to you at our website, hereandnow.org. Thank you.
Thank you.
And by the way, we'd love to hear your thoughts as well. Just go to hereandnow.org. We'll hear from you, too. You're listening to Here Now. Zora Neale Hurston was a writer, an anthropologist, and a folklorist. Born in 1891 in Alabama, she became the first African-American woman to enter Barnard College in New York, a leading intellectual in the Harlem Renaissance, and a colleague and friend of Langston Hughes. Her masterpiece, the 1937 book Their Eyes Were Watching God, was made into a film with Halle Berry playing Janie Crawford, desperate to be seen as something other than someone's wife.
The only way you and this whole town ever seen me was as Mrs. Mayor Stock, sitting out there on that porch, silk dresses on, all high and mighty, just as ladylike as you please. That might have been the Janie y'all knew, but that wasn't the Janie I ever.
Recognition came late for Zora Neale Hurston as well. She died impoverished in 1960. In 1973, a young author named Alice Walker would place a monument on the burial site to honor Hurston. And now two other young authors honor her as well with a new novel for young readers, Zora and Me. It imagines Zora Neale Hurston as a child. We want to talk about the book with the authors. Victoria Bond studied creative writing. Welcome.
Thank you.
And co-author Tanya Simon studied anthropology. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
So your book is highly researched. It won the approval of the Zora Neale Hurston Trust. It takes place in Eatonville, Florida, where Hurston's family moved when she was a young girl. So first, tell us about Eatonville and the Eatonville that Hurston grew up in.
Well, Eatonville was the first African-American incorporated town. So it's this very unique place, and it was a very special place. I think it might have been one of the few kinds of places that actually could produce someone like Zora, because it was Black achievement centered. You know, there wasn't a sense there that Black people were ever less than, especially under the boot heel of Jim Crow, because the mayor was Black, the town founders, to a large extent, were also Black. So there was a different kind of Black identity that was there that was not often in other places in the United States.
As others have put it, Zora Neale Hurston was never indoctrinated in inferiority. And the character that you've created, this young woman, first of all, how much research were you able to do on her as a young woman, Tanya?
Our research of Zora as a young woman, well, we read all of her works, and we read, of course, the biographies of her. And I think that for the creation of this book, more than the research itself was the way that Zora inhabited both our psyches. I think that's the main wellspring that she comes from.
How does she?
Differently for both of us. I think for me as a student of anthropology, I came to Their Eyes Were Watching God in college. I hadn't known about Zora before. I was probably 19 years old. And she was important to me, and her work really resonated with me as a young feminist. But I think it was later when I was in graduate school in anthropology, getting an MA, that I really understood how significant her intellectual contributions were to American letters.
And how would you sum that up?
I think that Zora is an iconoclastic figure. She's also an early feminist. She wasn't limited by convention or by normal boundaries. And I think that she saw all disciplines as her. She's an anthropologist. She's a writer. She's a folklorist. She's a traveler. She's a mischief maker. She's irrepressible. And I think that that's a very important legacy for women of all races, certainly, to have.
And Vicky, you are the one who studied creative writing. So how does she, what place does she hold in your psyche?
I think it's the beginning of Mules and Men. Zora writes that her cultural heritage as a Floridian, she wore it like a tight chemise, so she couldn't see it for wearing it. And then when she comes up north and goes to college, then she can take that garment off and examine it once she begins to see her earlier life from the perspective of a stranger.
Well, what a wonderful phrase.
I know. And it's just amazing that you would cast your racial and cultural identity in that way, but that it's not only a garment, but it's, you know, it's underwear, it's lingerie. Yeah. So she also casts this idea of identity in these strictly feminine terms, too. And you just think, wow, as a poet, it doesn't get much better than that.
Yeah. Well, so you've created this young Zora, and she is curious. She's almost the town reporter in Eatonville in the story that you tell. She's also got this fantastic imagination, and everywhere she sees lurking danger, and some of it very real. There's swimming holes where alligators eat people. There's also a black man that Zora and her friend Carrie befriend, and then he's found beheaded. They also meet a fantastical woman named Gold. It sounds as if you were trying to get across this Zora, the one you learned about as an adult, and try to find out where that adult came from.
Exactly. When I first had the idea of writing about Zora, I was actually pregnant, and I was thinking about my daughter and what kind of books she would read. And I was a huge fan of Caddy Woodlawn growing up.
Yeah.
And I grew up partly in the third world, and that idea that there would be a child that had access to nature and that was able to be unviolated. I wanted to give my daughter a sort of fearless black heroine, you know, and I kept thinking that young Zora was that woman.
What happened? You know, here she was the belle of the Harlem Ball, you know, friend of Langston Hughes. But as we said, she, in 1950, had to move back to Florida, work as a maid to support herself. We know she was falsely accused of molesting a young boy. But was there something else that happened to die so impoverished? No headstone until Alice Walker comes along years later to put it there.
Yeah, we have talked a lot about this amongst ourselves. You know, we think it's the perils of genius.
Look at Herman.
He wrote Moby Dick. No one liked it.
Yeah.
You know, Zora wrote Their Eyes Were Watching God. No one liked it.
Or people weren't ready for it. They're just some Van Gogh. I mean, there are certain creators that people aren't quite ready for in their time, and then they're going to be recognized later. Unfortunately, that happened for Zora. And of course, she was a black woman at a time where black femininity was deeply devalued. There was no safety net for Zora.
Yeah. You know, I think we have this sense of you're on the top of the world, you know, you are the toast of the Harlem Renaissance, and then you fall so low. From my experience of just getting to know Zora's work, I don't have the sense that she ever felt like she fell so low. I think that she had a very stable sense of herself and her gifts and her talents and knew that.
And her politics.
Right. And that, you know, things happen, circumstances change, but I don't think she ever looked in the mirror from, you know, the top, quote unquote, to the bottom and ever thought.
She didn't change. It was the people, whether or not
exactly.
the people accepted her.
I think also she only cared that she was able to create, and I don't think that she cared what context allowed that.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think that whether the context was luxurious or not luxurious, and I don't think she ever knew much luxury, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm.
I think the fact that she could die still in the middle of a creative endeavor was probably the most significant thing for her.
Will there be more of young adult books? Will we see more of Zora as a 10, 11, maybe 12-year-old?
Yeah, we have two more books. This
Great.
Is a trilogy.
Yeah. Great.
Taking her through the point where she finally leaves to join the circus troupe.
Great. That's Tanya Simon, co-author with Victoria Bond of the new novel for young readers. As we just heard, the first of three, Zora and Me. For more information, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Vicki, Tanya, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you.
Camgar mule on the mount, call him Jerry.
And this is a recording made in the 1930s of Zora Neale Hurston singing Mule on the Mountain. She said she first heard it as a young girl in Florida. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Join us again here and now.
Woman, she shakes like jelly all over. I got a woman, she shakes like jelly all over.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.